there's a thing that I learned when I worked at NASA. Mm-hmm. And any time that I had any sort of engagement with the NASA administrator, I would always have, what are the three things that we are doing in public affairs and communications that are helping the agency? You know, what are those three things? And it couldn't just be tactical, like, hey, we're talking to reporters, right? That's the tactical piece. What are the three strategic communication activities or campaigns that we're doing to advance the agency?
Welcome to the CEO Sessions, hosted by Ben Fanning. And here's Ben.
Hey there, and welcome to the show. I have Dina Costa with Lockheed Martin, who is their Chief Communications Officer and Senior Vice President. Lockheed Martin is a $65 billion global security and aerospace company with 114,000 employees worldwide, where Dean leads a team of 500, oversees global communication strategies, and provides strategic communications counsel to the corporation's senior executives. He's held senior leadership positions at NASA, Boeing, Honeywell, Phillips 66, and Resideo. And while at NASA, he was press secretary in the aftermath of the Space Shuttle Columbia tragedy, which we get into that during this episode, a very interesting piece you want to make sure to check out. And by the way, Dean's received an Emmy Award for his investigative reporting and holds a bachelor's degree from the University of Texas of San Antonio and a master's degree from Seton Hall University. Here's a little bit of what you'll discover in this episode. Number one, how to strike the balance of tooting your own horn and being humble, and how Dean's mettle was tested during the Columbia space shuttle crisis, as well as during the pandemic, key strategies that every leader can use to respond to a crisis, as well as how to have a steady hand during a crisis. And then we wind this thing up with success strategies that every employee should keep in mind, and then a twist in Dean's career that led to his success down the road. Enjoy the episode. If you're an executive at a crossroads in your career and thinking about quitting, do this before you do anything else. Head over to benfanning.com/quit to receive a free signed copy of my number one best-selling book, The Quit Alternative, The Blueprint for Creating the Job You Love Without Quitting. You'll learn the critical questions you must answer before you make such an impactful decision. Go to benfanning.com/quit to get this valuable resource for just the cost of shipping. Hey, Dean, welcome to the show.
Hey, Ben, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it. Look forward to the conversation today.
Yeah, I mean, it took us a while to get together, but now we're finally here, and I am just delighted on this day to be with you for this interview. Let's start this thing off by sharing a little bit about where you grew up.
Yeah, boy, it's a throwback, you know, throwback Friday. You know, I'll tell you, I grew up in San Antonio, Texas. And I was blessed to grow up with a firefighter and a teacher as my parents, and wow, super grounded folks. My mom was the first person in either of our families to graduate from college. And I came from an immigrant. We were second generation from Mexico. And my grandfather, my mom's dad, was taught us the whole, you know, where we came from, work ethic. Was a man that worked four jobs, woke up at, you know, 3:30 in the morning to go and, you know, clean toilets at a hotel. And then he threw a newspaper out, and he worked at the rail station, and he was a truck driver. And the man was always working, but he wasn't educated, right? He could barely, you know, actually he couldn't read or write. My mom would go in with his paychecks and would sign. He would sign an X and she would sign them. Wow. And that's how my family started. But he always really impressed upon us the importance of education, about hard work, and never making excuses. And so that's been ingrained in me and how I was raised and who I am as a leader. And so I never forget where I come from. And I'm only successful today because of my grandfather and my parents that allowed me and gave me opportunities to succeed. So I feel very blessed on the path that I've been able to take.
And so where in Mexico exactly? From what region is your family from?
Yeah, so more of the Monterrey area. Monterrey, okay. So not too far from the border town. But, you know, my grandfather and my grandmother was from Shiner, Texas. So she grew up around
as in Shiner Bach?
Yeah, as in Shiner Bock. That's where Shiner Bock comes
from, beer.
Right?
that's a great beer if you're a beer fan out there.
Yes, it is very much so. In fact, I remember Shiner Bock when I was just old enough to drink, and it was, you know, the stuff that you could get for cheap. It was like Natty Light. And now all of a sudden it's become, you know.
Yeah, now it's a little higher ed, right? It's a specialty beer out there.
It is. It's kind of interesting to me that it is, but yeah.
Yeah, we have to get a sponsorship from Shiner Bock here on
there. Yeah, no kidding on that one.
You know, one of the things you just mentioned too, but before we move on, is having a father as a firefighter and a mom as a teacher. And it's based on what I know of your career that we'll dive into in the next couple of questions. Teaching and addressing crisis are two key elements, right? Communicating, yep. And teaching and addressing crisis. Are you looking back? Do you see some intersection there with the way you saw growing up?
Yeah, no, I actually think that's a very astute observation there. And I don't know that I've ever thought of it that way, but you're exactly right. You know, and growing up, my mom was a speech therapist and a teacher, but always constantly helping us learn and putting it back on us, right? You know, today, you know, parents play a much more active role in educating children than I think when we were growing up. And so my mom would always kind of guide us, but it was on us to own the outcome. And my dad, you're right. I mean, I would go, I can remember all the time. It was always such a treat for my brother and I to go to the fire station and be able to slide down the pole and see him in action. And then, you know, inevitably the alarm would go off and they would run to, you know, get on the truck and go. And, you know, as a kid, that was, you know, my dad was Superman. So it was kind of cool to see that. And I think you're probably right. I mean, he always had this sense of urgency no matter what it was. I mean, even when the food got put down and we were going to eat, I mean, he was going to, you know, be focused on that and get it done. And, and I think that definitely was ingrained in me and understood about, and he was always so cool and calm. You know, he moved up to a captain in the fire department, and he was always cool and never got himself worked up. And I think that was also a huge influence on me about having a steady hand and the team looking for leaders to stay grounded during a situation. I think that's been an impact, huge impact on my
Those role life models early in life. You know, they can really make a positive impact. Moving on just a little bit here. So, how did your experience as a college athlete and sportscaster, which I think is so cool, inform your professional life today? So, we talked about, you know, your parents and your upbringing. Now we're getting into where you're beginning to sort of understand a little bit about what skills come to you. What was that like?
Yeah, it was interesting, you know, how we have our paths in life. And sometimes we think we're really in control of it and not really, you know, we really aren't. But I will tell you, coming out of college, I don't know about you, Ben, but I was fairly clueless. I did not know what I wanted to do, where I wanted to go. I got my degree in political science and history in undergrad because I liked it, not because I had any plan. And I had a really good friend that was going to go to law school. And I was like, okay, I'll take the LSAT and try to go to law school. Like that was, you know, that was the grand plan for Dean. Mm-hmm. Along the line, I met a couple of friends that worked in television. And so one of which, and I played high school sports in San Antonio, and there was a sportscaster there named George McKenzie. And out of the blue, I just called him and said, George, I'm graduating from college. I have no idea what I want to do in my life and career, but I really love sports and I played sports. Well, he remembered covered me in high school and he said, come on down, let's meet. He goes, I got my undergrad degree in political science and history and didn't know what I wanted to do either. So why don't you come down? So I went down, he goes, look, I can't pay you anything. You can be an intern for me, but I'll teach you everything you need to know. So I did that for 3 months. I was there all the time, never got paid. And worked my tail off and learned how to be a sportscaster, what it took to write, how to edit tape, how to, you know, I knew sports, but it's a different thing. So I did that and I was able to land my first job. And funny story, I'll share with you, Ben. Try not to take us down too much of a rabbit hole. But I was there, you know, I was the intern. So everybody was going to dinner one night. And as the intern, I had to stay behind. They're like, we'll bring you something to eat. You need to monitor the games and pick up the phones. So I was like, all right, fine. So I'm there, I'm watching the games. I think the Spurs were playing and phone call comes in and hello, you know, sports, and the other end, it was a news director down in Laredo, Texas. And he said, "Hey, my sportscaster, weekend sportscaster, just quit. And I was calling to see if you had any really hotshot interns or anybody that was good that's looking to break into the business." And I said, "As a matter of fact, we have this great intern. His name's Dean Acosta, and he is going to be a rock star. And we think, you know, you should talk to him and hire him." He's like, "Oh, wow, this guy sounds great." And he goes, "You know, send me his tape. And do you have his contact information?" I said, "Of course." And I gave it to him and all this stuff. And he goes, "Well, who am I talking to?" I'm like, "Oh, this is Don Harris." And so I had to tell my friend Don, who was the morning, like, "Hey, this is what I did. It's not exactly probably something I'm going to be proud of. However, it got me in a conversation." So I went down and interviewed for the job and ended up getting it. I was honest about that I was the guy on the call with the news director. And he thought that was funny and said, "Hey, look, I was just looking for somebody and you answered the phone." And so that's how I started my sportscasting.
That is fantastic. And to me, it also shows the importance of being able to toot your own horn a little bit. I mean, you were literally tooting your own horn in that situation, but too many times, you know, I think people hold back when they see an opportunity and you went for it. Right. I mean, you could have gone on down there and bombed the interview, but at that moment you're like, "Hey, I'm going to step up here and put myself forward because I think I can do this." And
I think that's such a really good point, Ben, because it's a teachable moment for a lot of us early in our careers that you have to advocate for yourself. And even as I learned moving up in my career, that it's really important to not only advocate for yourself, but advocate for your team and be able to showcase, you know, we always hear that the analogy of a tree falls in the forest and nobody's there, it doesn't make a sound, right? Mm-hmm. And if you do all these great things and you don't bring attention to, or at least show the business value of what you're doing, help connect the dots. Like, we did these things and this is how it helped the business. Well, then business leaders will pay attention to that. But if you're just doing activity for activity's sake and don't explain how it connects to the greater good, then that's the things that I think we have to do even better as communicators and people that are not business leaders that are part of corporate America.
So break that down for me, since you are, you know, a ninja Jedi communications person here. You got people listening today. They're like, "Yes, it makes sense what Dean's talking about, advocating for myself, communicating, highlighting the work of myself and my team." What's the first step for someone who's really been hiding, you know, from their leadership? They want to stay out of the limelight because it feels safe. And as soon as you start tooting your own horn, advocating for yourself, highlighting stuff, it puts you more in the spotlight and they feel like that's a risky place to be. What's your advice for them?
Yeah, no. And I think that's a good point. And I would like to delineate, there's a fine line between arrogance and confidence, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
So I think you have to be very careful about, like, "Oh, look at me, I'm great," versus, "All right, let me. So there's a thing that I learned when I worked at NASA. Mm-hmm. And anytime that I had any sort of engagement with the NASA administrator, I would always have, "What are the three things that we are doing in public affairs and communications that are helping the agency? You know, what are those three things?" And it couldn't just be tactical, like, "Hey, we're talking to reporters," right? That's the tactical piece. What are the three strategic communication activities or campaigns that we're doing to advance the agency? And I learned that I always had those three, and they would change, right? But I always was prepared that no matter, even if it was like we're getting on the elevator together, I would say, "Hey, you know, Mike, let me share the three things that we're working on right now that I think you'll be interested in." And so it wasn't about Dean, and it wasn't really even about the public affairs office, but it was about what we were doing to advance the mission. I think that's the advice that I would give to your listeners, is that try to think about it from, you know, it's as simple as understanding your audience, right? CEOs, business leaders typically are, you know, accountants or engineers at heart. And when you can think about it from a business lens, and the things that you're doing within your function or activity or group that are advancing the business, then you will have an interested audience member. And that's what I try to think about and do. And I still do that today. When I talk to my CEO or the members of our executive leadership team, I'm always thinking about what are the things we're doing that would advance their cause or the mission of our company, and why would they be interested in that?
Yeah, two things that really resonate there with me, everyone, is number one, Dean said, make sure to understand your audience, know who you're speaking to. And two, you use the word contribution. So you have achievements, great things that you and your team are doing, but if you communicate it as in terms of what's the contribution to the mission, that's the magic word that takes it from probably boasting to really resonating with your audience in a really powerful way.
That is spot on, Ben. I couldn't have said it better myself. That's exactly that line too.
So I want to get into, I know it's a sensitive area, but it shows where that comes into play a lot. And these are two of your, I'll say, and you may have others, but there were two in your background, two big marquee moments where big crisis and you really had to step up. And I'm curious, how was your mettle tested during the Columbia space shuttle crisis and in the pandemic? And what advice do you have for others who are facing crisis in their own careers and businesses?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And one that I think a lot about. You know, when I was with NASA, and you might remember back in the day, there was before Columbia, there was a space shuttle Challenger that happened back in October.
I remember watching that in school. Yeah, I remember seeing it on television. Too, right?
I was watching it live and saw
it. Yeah, terrible.
And, oh my, horrible, right? But it is really a case study still today on how not to handle a crisis, right? Hmm. NASA circled the wagons. They like, we got this. Nobody needs to look here. We're going to, you know, deal with it. Congress stepped in. There was the Rogers Commission. It became a, you know, the O-ring was the smoking gun, if you will.
Oh, yeah, the O-ring. And, I remember.
Yeah, yeah. I remember that. Mm-hmm. And NASA was really, it was an indictment of groupthink, an indictment on how, you know, on transparency. And really, it was, you know, it's a case study still today on how not to handle a crisis. Fast forward, nobody wants to have to apply that, but NASA did learn. And I was lucky enough to be front and center with the organization when we went through Columbia, another sad situation where we mm-hmm. lost seven lives. But in how the crisis was handled, Sean O'Keefe, who was the NASA administrator at the time, was just a top-notch big leader. And how he leaned in, how he appreciated the importance of complete transparency, organizing an outside Columbia Accident Investigation Board early on. And then we just learned things about everything we did. We would meet daily, and it wasn't just comms. It was across all of the entire agency. And that was one of the takeaways for me, is the importance of how you have to be in tune and tied into your executive leaders, but every function and every group that's part of an organization is playing a role, and particularly your employees. So how are you communicating to them and recognizing anything you say to employees are going to get out externally, share exactly what you're doing and be purposeful of what you're doing and why. And we really did that in the NASA situation. Fast forward to the pandemic, right? Nobody goes to school and plans for a global pandemic that's going to last longer than a year, which is the situation we're in today. And we went from Lockheed Martin, we, you know, 110,000 plus employees, 114,000 today globally. Pre-pandemic, we had a roughly 5% of those employees that worked virtually or teleworked. After the lockdowns are happening, we went from 5% to 70%. So not only does that tax your, you know, IT infrastructure and your architecture, but it's a whole different mindset on how you work, how you engage with your employees, how do you keep things, you know, your protocols in place for employees that had to come to our manufacturing sites, because we still have to produce the F-35 and we still have to produce the helicopter, the CH-53K for our U.S. government and ally customers. So that had to happen. We had to make sure we set up those facilities in a way that our employees felt confident. And it was also true to our values as a company. So, you know, a lot of communications that are happening there. So early on, our CEO, Marilyn Hewson, we were constantly communicating. Here are the things, the steps we're doing. Here's how we're working. Here are the protocols that we're putting in place. And that was critical. And some of the best feedback we've got from our employees were, you know, can't tell you how important it was to hear all of that information and hear it from our CEO. And then during that time, we had a CEO transition, and our new CEO, Jim Taiclet, leaned in the same way. So communicating constantly, helping to give updates, understanding and being an empathetic leader. And all of those principles applied. So I've learned along the line, there's some things in that. So some of the key themes that I would offer to your listeners is mm-hmm. one is really involve more people in the conversation, not less.
Yes.
When you think you're over communicating, you're not. And transparency and authenticity need to be key principles and ingredients in how you approach your communications.
Get a simple tool to approximate your cost of turnover in 10 seconds or less. Right now, go to benfanning.com/turnover. Did you know the average cost of turnover is $235,975 per employee per year? If you're like most leaders, you don't know your number. Go to benfanning.com/turnover right now and download the simple tool to start getting a handle on this catastrophic cost. As a C-suite leader, how do you think through, hey, this is information that's so sensitive. We want to be transparent, but we can't be transparent on this. Like, how should a leader be thinking through that in their organization in terms of what they share in the name of transparency versus what they may delay or not share with the broader community?
Yeah, that's a hard one, right? Because you got to think about what's business critical and what is secret sauce. And there's something that fits into your strategy that is going to be a competitive advantage and help advance your business. That's usually the line. But when it comes to things like protocols or safety protocols that you're putting in place or things that you're doing as an essential workforce for the country, those things you need to yell from the top of the mountain and share that with your employees, mm-hmm. share that with the communities where you operate. And then the other principles are, we have such a great grounded set of values for Lockheed Martin, staying true to those principles and making sure that when you are making decisions or doing activities in which you think are going to advance the business, that they're staying true and tight to your principles and that you're communicating the connection point to your employees, to your shareholders, to your customers, all of those things matter. And I think that's kind of how you draw the line and think about it.
Yeah.
But I've always fallen on I always go to share more versus less. And let's make sure that we agree that it is going to help with the culture and engagement of our employees, and it helps our customers to understand what we're doing and how it's helping their cause and their mission.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense there. Thanks for drawing that line. I think that'll help leaders to think through their own policies in terms of how they're approaching communications and transparency. Moving on just a little bit, I know that you've been really putting a lot of thought into the workforce of the future and how the pandemic's affecting that. And one of the things that comes up, we work a lot around the catastrophic cost of turnover. And so I'm curious, pandemic, working remotely, workforce of the future, and potential employee burnout from working remotely and turnover. How is all of this coming together for you? And how are you thinking through this?
Yeah, that's a lot there, right? And a lot to unpack about. No, but you're right. When you think about it, it's not as a simple equation or a math problem, right? There's a lot of different variables there. And it's a complex problem that I think not only Lockheed Martin is grappling with, but I think any business in corporate America, from small business,
absolutely,
medium size to very large, to figure out how do we go do this? And as I mentioned earlier, we went from, a virtual workforce of 5% to 70%.
Yep.
So I think what we learned as business leaders at Lockheed Martin were, number one, pre-pandemic, 5% working virtually, probably not the right number. And then post-pandemic, 70% is probably not sustainable. So what is that sweet spot? And so that's part of what we're studying right now to understand what that right percentage of employees working virtually.
All right.
Is there a hybrid, right? It's like, do you have things like anchor days where you may bring teams in where they can interact with one another one day a week or once every couple of weeks, and they all come together, but yet can space, and you can still have the safety protocols in place, but yet the teams can still engage and connect, and it's more than just Zoom, right?
Yeah.
And then longer term, what does that look like from an employee that works 100% of the time virtually to maybe one day out of the week coming into the work into our facilities to, how do you create more flex space where, you know, back in the day we would call it hoteling, but what does that flex space look like where people can come in, and then the safety protocols after they leave, cleaning it, make sure the next person that comes in has a really good, safe working environment at the facility. So all of those things are, and items and activities are something that what we're talking about in a campaign and an activity that we're calling Lockheed Martin or LM Forward, you know, the forward of the future of workforce.
All right.
And there's some business decisions you need to make, right? Do you need as much lease space? Do you need as much space in general if you're going to have 25 to 30% of your workforce working virtually? Maybe you need more space that will be flex space versus dedicated office space. Mm-hmm. So we're working through all of that right now to understand what that could look like, what roles could be more virtual versus roles that you'll need at the facility. And I'm really confident that we're taking that on as a leadership team at Lockheed Martin, but also recognizing that it's going to be really important to how you keep your workforce, your, you know, keep it sold to your employees, and to attracting your future workforce. Because I think there's going to be one of two things. The companies that do this well and figure it out are going to get the top-notch talent that you're going to need, whether it's engineers or scientists or software engineers that are going to want flexible work schedules, that are going to want to have and be able to call, you know, how often they go to the facilities versus not. How does it work for work-life balance? And all of those, the companies that figure that out and at least offer enough of a menu of options to their key teams and key talent are going to be the companies that get the top talent. And then every other company that doesn't do that will be playing catch up.
Yeah, I like this. A couple of benefits you mentioned there. One is sort of the nuts and bolts of it. Hey, we may not need as much office space, or we may need a different kind that's not as expensive. But then all, for the employee side of it, yeah, I can definitely see you're going to have that buffet of options potentially, and you'll be able to attract people, maintain them. Have you noticed, or what have you noticed around like employee burnout and things of that nature during this time? Because that switch was so dramatic. What have you noticed in the company, if anything?
Definitely have noticed it. And something that we're paying close attention to as a leadership team at Lockheed Martin. I can tell you personally in comms, I've seen it just because, you know, when you work virtually, it's hard to draw that line and have almost that buffer between work time, personal time, family time, right?
Yeah.
And you, how many times have you been on a Zoom call where the dog's barking in the background, or, you know, the son or daughter comes up and says, "Mommy, I'm hungry. Daddy, I'm hungry." You know, it's constant. And now we've kind of become immune to it. It's kind of people chuckle, but you keep moving on. And I think what we've realized is that, boy, folks are working longer. They're working harder.
Yes.
And how do you balance? And so there's a couple of things that I've really, you know, tried, some principles that I've really tried to keep our team focused on. And I said, look, one, you know, we got to be safe. You got to take care of ourselves and make sure that we have that work-life balance. I think it's super important to not only work hard, but work smart and balance it, right? Keep personal life balance. That's just as important as I've always said, family first, then the mission. You got to take care of yourself and your family. If you can't do that, then it's going to be harder to deliver for the company and for your mission. Staying focused, another really important item. And then, you know, part of that is also being okay with raising your hand. I need help, or I need time, or I need space here. And that's okay. Like, that's good. We got to celebrate that and understand that. And that's something that we've really pushed on. And then during this time, as we're going through, being able to reflect, right? You're running 100 miles an hour because we're working, you know, remotely or virtually. Being able to step back and saying, what's working for me, for my team, for my work-life balance? What isn't working? And let's evaluate that. And what can we be even better if? And I always preach that to my team. You know, a lot of good accomplishments, but what could be even better if, and balanced life, work-life balance even better? And then what I've asked the team is, you know, we're running 100 miles an hour, and I know that, but always assume positive intent. Like, let's balance each other and recognize we're all on the same team. Let's start at that point and then work to solve problems. And just those principles I laid out, I've seen a real positive cultural impact with the communications department at Lockheed Martin. We continue to get better and work at it, but the burnout factor is something I'm keeping a close eye on. And I try to really stay true to those principles and remind the team so we can keep that balance there.
I love it. And we often ask for three success tips that every employee should keep in mind. And you just gave them like six. Yeah. I mean, some really great ones. Family first, then the mission. Stay focused, raise your hand when you need space. Take time to be reflective, assume positive intent. I mean, those are some big ones and some great ones to keep in mind. What's one trait that you wish you could instill in every employee?
Yeah. Another great question, Ben. I would say, critical thinking skills, right? A lot of times, no matter what you do, whether it's communications or engineering, or you're a scientist or software engineer, you know, we are so wired as a society and a culture and as a country on the outcome and the results. And a lot of times we do things because we just want to run to the surge. And so what I've asked my team is, look, critical thinking skills are the most important thing. And maybe we've done this 10 times and it's been successful. We should always question, why were we successful those 10 times? Mm. And is there something to learn from it that we can be better at, maybe do it more efficiently? Or is there a new set of variables that we need to understand that maybe the 11th time, the same way we did it the previous 10, isn't going to work? And so I think a lot of times, and the star athletes, the star performers and employees on my team are the ones that step back and ask those types of questions often and don't always assume that what we've done in the past is automatically going to work in the future. And so I would challenge your listeners to always have that lens and understand it. It doesn't mean stop and go slow, but it also means ask yourself, why is something working? You know, understand the data or the effectiveness of what you're doing, and then realize, is there a way to do it more efficiently? Or are there other variables now that are introduced that may, you know, keep that same approach from being successful in the future? And that's what that I think I try to coach the most with my team, and really keep myself honest and develop and keep that lens on as a leader.
It reminds me of the brutality of the five whys, Six Sigma, where you have the listeners, you're not familiar with that. You basically get asked why five times at least whenever you give a response to something, and it is brutal, but it does teach you critical thinking. It makes you think deeper and deeper and deeper. So just a couple more, Dean, then I know we got to get you out of here. When's the time you had an unexpected twist or failure in your career, and how did it lead to your growth or success on down the road?
Yeah, I think back to my time. I think I mentioned to you earlier how I became a sportscaster, and you know, in my second job, I was in my first job for about 6 months. Went to my second job, which was a weekend sportscaster in Corpus Christi, Texas. Right, it was a place that I used to go to as a kid, you know, on the weekends to go fishing. And I was a television person in the market, and it wasn't a big market, but it was bigger than I was ready for at that point in my career. And I had a great news director that took a chance on me and thought I could grow into the job. And I did, you know, it wasn't from a lack of working hard, but I just wasn't ready. Mm-hmm. And about 9 months in, he came to me and said, look, this isn't working. I'm going to have to go in a different direction. So I got fired for the first time in my career in life. And I was really, you know, really took it hard, but it was my, the experiences that I had as an athlete and recognize you don't always win all the time. And you don't hit that last shot, or you don't, you know, score at the end to win the game. And it was drawing on some of those failures that you had to dust yourself off and not play the victim card, recognize that you're responsible for your career and responsible for the fate that you had. And it is how you handle that adversity. Mm. I had a great coach in high school that always reminded me that a true champion wasn't how they acted when they won a game. A true champion was somebody that handled adversity or a loss in a way that made them work harder and come back as a champion. And I never forgot that life lesson. And so from that point, I worked harder. I did well in my next job. It took me 6 months to get my next job, but I got my next job. I made the most of it. I was prepared for it. And my career, you know, took off from there. And I was blessed for another opportunity, but I never made myself a victim. And I worked hard at recognizing what my flaws were and the part of the process that I had to own. And what could I do to be better, you know, the next time I had an opportunity?
Yeah, I love that. And it's almost like changing your expectation too. If you don't expect to have any failures, when you do have one, it's going to be a lot more crushing and it can be more of a setback. And if you recognize, like you did in that moment, that, hey, success doesn't happen on a straight line up and to the right. It does have its bumps as you go along, and it's like, hey, this is a dip in the path, but it's not the end.
And it's so true. By the way, if you look at our country's successes, just, you know, on the space side, there were so many times that our scientists and engineers learned early on in the Apollo program and Gemini before that, you know, where there were not successes, but they learned from it and they quickly iterated fast and became better and then ultimately got us to the moon. You know, that's just a reminder. I think engineers innately, you know, resonate with that, you know, failing fast and understanding why you failed and improve it will get you a little further the next step. And it's okay. You just got to learn from the failure, not let it take you completely all the way back and give up.
Wrapping this thing up, Dean, what books, podcasts, or websites do you recommend for someone who's not in the C-suite yet, or maybe they're on their way, but they just want to get there? What kind of recommendations do you have for them?
Yeah, one of the books, and I'm sure you hear this from a lot of leaders, is the Jim Collins Good to Great. I have that on my shelf. I read that, you know, every couple of years just to remind me of how, as a leader, what are the attributes you need to have and demonstrate. Yeah. How do you get the right people in the right seats on the bus, right? You might have great talent, but if you're not have them put in the right seats and they're not gelling as a team, then that's on you as a leader. That's something that I really have taken from there. And then probably some of the other ones, you know, I read The Right Stuff when I was at NASA, you know, what a great book to inspire and influence. And I read a recent one called Ghost Fleet, which I really enjoyed. My whole leadership team read this. We did almost like a book club. It's called Ghost Fleet, and Ghost it's about Fleet. The future. And it's the future of war, and what it will take in the future when you know, China and Russia, ironically, become super, you know, even stronger than the U.S. and what it takes when it comes to the connectivity and big data and how our platforms need to all work together if we're gonna remain a superpower and have deterrence going forward. It's a fascinating book.
I gotta check
that
out.
Well done, and it's a good read. Yeah. So I would encourage that as well.
Well, Dean, wrapping up here, anything that you did? Any last parting message for our listeners?
Yeah, Ben, thanks for the opportunity to sit down and talk with you. I think we covered a lot of really great topics and subjects. I think a couple of things that I would just close with your listeners is, you know, during this time, I think many of us have gone through it's probably an overused word, but unprecedented situation in dealing with the pandemic, and it's been global. I would encourage your listeners to do a couple of things. Make sure that you take some time and pause to understand learnings during this last year. What are the things that you've done differently, no matter what it is, whether it's engaging with your family? What are some of the good things? And then what are the things that you definitely don't want to repeat? You know, like a couple of things that we've done, you know, as a family. I'm blessed with four daughters and they're all under the age of 13. So they keep daddy on his toes. Yeah. And I have a wonderful wife. But we've introduced game night where we do board games. And it's something that we never did before the pandemic, but we started doing, and it's been something that's really brought us closer together.
What's your favorite board game?
So right now it's a card game, and we've been playing Uno and the follow-up, which is called Dos. And my 5-year-old just loves it, and we play it all the time. And then Trivial Pursuit, right? That one never gets old, and it's a long one. And the family also enjoys Monopoly. So those are kind of the big ones that are go to.
Yeah.
But it's funny because we didn't do that before, and it's something that I think we will carry on. And so I would just encourage your listeners to not forget those moments, because it'll be easy to whatever we go back to whatever the new normal is and forget some of these maybe great memories or lessons learned that you can apply and maybe go forward in your personal life and your professional life.
Fantastic, Dean. Thanks for being on today, man.
Really enjoyed it, Ben.
Want to boost your productivity and decision-making? Get vital insights from each episode delivered directly to your inbox. A great resource, whether you've listened to the episode or not. Go to benfanning.com/insight.
Ben Fanning is a number one best-selling author, Inc. magazine columnist, and CEO of The Fanning Group, an international consultancy and corporate training company. To learn how they can help your organization, go to benfanning.com.